morning because the National Treatment Against Years Fund, she worked with the state again today. That's the debt drive.
So we also picked up our three issues that we were on the top with the NRA, the issue of transportation and the human needs and everything. So we were able to have the advantage. And I don't know whether I'm interested in the
presented it today. And I have outlined each other. So Of course, we don't know the DA party view so far in relation to the whole framework of policy issues that has been presented. I'm relating to the stakeholders in relation to what they raised in the meeting. So there were only three issues that we had studied after the 2001. Because I, every time when Young represented, I stopped to find out which specifically they need to be rediscussed. And out of those nine, there were only three. And he said to go and engage and clarify us. So Young will clarify us on those issues. And I've outlined them. One of them is contesting statement. Yes. And the second one, for instance, was on the BCC. Mm-hmm. And then he said, I can't remember what he said on the ECR. So basically, it was those things. And I don't know at what point will the DA party coalition come. It's going to be that work. I don't have in front of me a prepared document that will speak to all of us, unless the younger has re-prepared the document of all the points that we need to have.
Yeah, well,
the
okay, so I think just since you want us to talk about the three issues.
I think I managed that you want to
okay.
But remember you need to put this also to the report. So I don't know how long you want
to okay.
There are no issues
there. No, there's no new issues. I thought you want us to respond to send the list to the CDK. And let me just put you at ease. I don't think on the non-fat rate issue and so on, you know, we haven't updated. I don't think that should take more than
45 minutes.
Okay.
No, it's just that we clear what he's doing today. And then we're not coming back to it. We don't have time. 1 o'clock or 3 o'clock, we are finished. Party political position, we come back and we take the trip and we give you the vote.
Yeah.
That's what you want.
Yeah.
Cooperate.
Thank you. Music to my ears.
If you say you have to take a very legitimate and cooperate.
So, Chair, I think.
If
it isn't the issues, and yeah, I know something on this issue, okay, I wasn't here yesterday. But maybe to deal with the first issue, which is the view of the state on that. I think for us the difficulty has been that just a process issue. You know, I'm happy to see the Ombud being militant about the changes they want, and I think from where they sit, I understand fully the changes that they want. And especially given the past 2 years' experience, they do have a point that we must seriously consider. I'm not saying that solution is the best way, but we understand that. You know, we also want to bring amendments to the SARS Act and sort out the clarified reporting line to the Commission, to the Minister of Finance, and so on. But, you know, in discussions with around the Judge Mingus Commission, we felt then that we rather wait, because part of their terms of reference is to look at the government issue. Part of their mandate is to look at the vaccine transition and come up with how we get, you know, how to sharpen the role of other players, be it the tax ombuds, be it, you know, the 2 Fridays ago, or Friday, not last Friday, Friday before last, the minister was there and Judge Davis was there, and we were there a few days before that. They really focused on the governance issues, and even the notion of an inspector general came up. Because the Ombud does certain things on behalf of taxpayers who are complaining, but you might want a stronger power. Okay? So I'm just saying these were things that we discussed at the commission. What we're saying is that just as we felt disappointed we haven't brought the SARS amendment, we're saying let's wait for the Nugent Commission's report. It may or may not comment in more detail on all these issues, but after they've done it, we can then take into account those comments and do them pretty early. I know it's an election year next year, and I guess that's why there's, you know, everybody wants their amendments through. So, yet, there's no difference. The issue is just the timing. And can we just wait for the new information report? And that's been the minister's viewpoint and his communication expressed that. I don't know if Yanga wants to add on that. So, it's not that we're not ready. We're saying let's wait for the process. If you're going to rush something now, you might still have to change it once the building commission actually comes out with a present proposal. So I think that's the issue with the combine. And that's why we're saying, for now we're saying, it's too late for the cycle. Let's not deal with making any amendment now. I think on the issue of the DTI, and there's two NABLAC processes that we are busy with. One is actually three. ETI, retirement reform, and the carbon tax. On ETI now there's agreement. I think there's just a matter of the formal signing off of the agreement. But we are confident enough to say that there's agreement to extend by 10 years, okay? Subject to certain things that they want, etc. So we have enough now to proceed with the amendment to continue. So I think that is also sorted out. We can talk through the issues later on the slide about where we are with the team. So I think that too is an outstanding issue. I think will fall away. Issue that you didn't mention, even on retirement reform, we're in the process of getting a signed agreement on how we should focus on retirement reform. And obviously they've asked for an extension, but in return they've committed to timelines on certain urgent issues around retirement reform. So we think that there's some progress on that, and that's why we should, in this bill now, continue with the extension. On the third issue, and which we'll come to, they were asked for reports on mitigation of losses if the carbon tax were to be put in place. There are ongoing discussions. I don't think that should hold up the bill, and we'll come to that later and explain why. But I think there's pretty good discussions going on. I know that the chair, you have raised, and we are just as concerned, that on the sugar beverage level too, as government, we said we'd take up issues and so on. I can tell you, not from the Treasury side that there's any delay. Okay? There are some issues which we're trying to iron out within government, because EDD is leading the process, and I don't know why those meetings have not taken place, but for us, I think those are important meetings to continue with. So I think those are the process issues around NABLAC, and they go a bit beyond the ETI as well. And we deal with, have a comment on the two and the third issue.
Okay. Thank you. On the two issues, the first issue is amendments to Mineral and Petroleum Resources Royalty Act. As we have said in the past year, that we are changing the way from expenditure in cash. Because when we introduced the mineral royalty, we had amount residual and the policy royalty. And then we changed it to expenditure in cash. And we found that when we use expenditure in cash, other costs can be any other cost. It's not actually in cash, because the way it was Section 11A in the Act say actually in cash. So we found that there should be a temporary expenditure that is not actually in place that can claim. And when you claim that expenditure, I mean that you reduce the amount of royalty that you pay, because royalty costs minus this expenditure and then. So if you have more expenditure to deduct, mean that the royalty you pay is less. And this is the whole purpose of having mineral royalty if you're gonna pay less. So now we are finding the policy intent to say that we go back to the original way we had when we introduced the mineral, as I said, amount reduced on accrual. Yes, there's been different arguments on this, but we think that the original way is okay. But I received the opinion this morning. I've not had the time to, I just looked at it round, but I cannot say that I've looked at it to be able to say anything. But that said, if there are anything, because our position is still there, because we are going back to the original wording that we had in the mineral royalty. But we are happy to meet with the industry to discuss this, because only two comments made on this issue, so we can move forward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Can I ask? Yes, Greg Smith from PwC. There is, look, I mean, we had the workshops and it was briefly discussed in the workshops. Well, there was a discussion of the workshops that became fairly heated quite quickly. You know, the decision was made there just to sort of stop the discussion and take the discussion offline. I asked Treasury to take the discussion offline and just try and clarify what their position is. What we see now in the response document is, look, we're reverting back to the original position. To the extent that there is some kind of commitment to engage in further discussion, we welcome that. You know, I'm not an NPRA expert, but I know that our clients are feel very, very strongly about this amendment, and I think it's maybe it's a question of Treasury and industry talking past each other. Maybe it's just a matter of actually talking these matters through. So we welcome further engagement on the matter, and I think it shouldn't just be limited to the two people who made comments. You know, there was quite a lot of presence at the workshops. There was presence of quite a lot of people who didn't necessarily make comments on the draft bill, but subsequently became aware of the issue. So, yeah, I think, you know, consultation would be welcome in that.
You know, Chair, you guys were on the committee of the meeting. You know, consultation about those things that you need to do something else in relation to our implementing education. Now, I'll speak on behalf of government. If we're going to ensure that any process where there's going to be the engagement about where the schools should be in the education, it leads us to a point where we look at what is the legal advisor say should be the high priority. And you see, going to and fro on this point of the day is important. And we're looking at the legal implication and advocate thinking to here. Maybe you might want to pay attention that specific one, because that's going to delay the engagement between the industry and national treasury. But I just consulted with the chair. The discussion can continue up until we become the final bit of the business. We can't take it beyond that, because voting is going to happen. And the difficulty is that we will not be here to re-engage on the same matter as Parliament is rising today. So, Chair, I think your view about that can now change about how that can be carried out. But I understand why perhaps the National Children and I have to spend the discussion to have them offline. It's like in a very volatile environment where people just run through their views and the situation becomes in such a way that others want their views to change. Of course, you need to find a way of dealing with that situation, because it's not a healthy engagement situation. Because to me, the understanding is not about who's got the strongest view. The issue is how relevant is the view in the engagement, and is it feasible to implement, and does it also obscure certain power? Because the reality is, it's an engagement, it's a consultation, that necessarily gives certain people power to decide what should go into the situation. The final arbiter on the legislature is the legislature to decide. And if they've obscured, if we obscure the constitution in relation to how we proceed, it's legal. So I think we need to find each other in the discussion to make it easier, not cumbersome for engagement, because we're losing time in the process when people just don't want to find a compromise position. So if there is anything to the previous text is to try and address the issues that were raised, let it be explained in order to finalize this matter and we don't find ourselves going to and from on the same issue when we don't have adequate time to proceed on it. So I will be specified. I don't know, are you happy?
I'm happy with that. I think, you know, we need to obviously be cognizant of the timelines and the limits on the time, but this is an extremely important issue, and I'm not saying that you know, I'm not taking a position on it. I'm not saying that the industry's right, and I'm not saying that the Treasury's right. What I'm saying is there does need to be some discussion on this, even if it's just to clarify what the policy position is, so that everybody knows where they are.
I think the points you make are important, and I think and even for the department, when we meet the industry, we don't make decisions there. You know, we look at it as trade-off, and I think it's not a negotiation with any taxpayer. It's hearing the view, coming to the view, and then coming to Parliament with how we say we can resolve it. I think, Chetan, the other point to make is that, and as I was saying, it's music to my ears, we like to close on all issues with the response document. Often what happens, though, there are, you know, one or two small tech, and not on the hot issues. When they're hot issues, then we've had the subcommittee approach that's been taken. I'm not sure that we're there yet. Okay, so we hear them because it just comes to our attention late and for the first legal opinion. But barring that, I think we're ready to roll. And bear in mind, what we do is that, though the committee will look at the clauses, a lot of the clauses aren't going to be amended. Just if you look at the response document, each of those points where there's changes, it means that those clauses will be changed. And so when we formally table the vote, obviously we still have to say to you as a committee that, you know, these changes are all in line with the original vote plus what the response document is stated. Okay. And then you may still choose to have hearings or go into any particular matters today, you know, controversial, etc. But we'd like today to finish all issues. And I think on this one, you know, we can come back, and certainly when we come back on the taking of the bill, that's when we have to sort of make a change and alert the committee. And I think if we can, we'll alert you before we make those changes, obviously. That's, but we're hoping to be able to solve issues.
I'm talking the chair a bit, because on the 8th, the chair does not want a situation where there is discussion on the matter, which will be a voting vote. And specifically because some of us won't be allowed to re-engage on those issues. So within giving that time frame, actually we are talking about 3 weeks to finalize on this. Because the last thing is it should not okay. So that's why I said if comes to a point, and Yanga, I know it's your opinion, you want to keep it and consult. Don't worry, I at least I've got an idea what happens in the legal environment, because there's a lawyer in the meeting, I think there are things that lawyers do. So consult as much as you can, as quick as you can, and engage with the on it, because I know you're not yet communicating to anybody in depth in terms of the implication, and sometimes we want to contest certain views and so on. We don't want to get in that. That's why we think our lawyer might also help us to look at those aspects that might compensate in engagement and look at how we can deal with them during this period. And we should care if we can communicate with them. But he doesn't want to have settled to find the matter coming on the 8th.
Basically, I agree with everything that the chair said. What's the past debate? And maybe you can help me out. To summarize it, and I'm not writing the case, and what he has said, and let's give out our other people, is that he found the vehicle needs on the 8th. In that first week, we're dealing with the week that we're out. In the week after, the week of the 15th, we want to have the version of the bill before us that is going to be formally taken.
In version.
Now, for the time is, always we've had the or an agreement that we have for the week. So what you get this, what you bring to the NCG here, is the final version that we see. Then we do not that's what COVID was. It's complicated. This is the only bill in the parliament that I've done with it, like this, and those are new members. Yeah, will not understand it. We need to brief them. So it's an informal bill. But because we have public hearings on an informal bill, and moreover, we encourage the parties at variance to meet outside of parliament, sometimes we send some people, sometimes it's a subcommittee. When the bill is tabled by the minister formally, it's exactly the bill we finish having hearings on. We do not have hearings again, unless, as you say, Momo, there's something very different in the version you brought formally, which we ourselves haven't agreed. So it's unlikely to have hearings. And some of the people in the who are new to us in the gate. Secondly, Momo and I, Sunday, I was out number of the day, right? Momo and I, I'm tired of reading this. You're the chair, I'm just being procedure matters. I'm not taking over the lead. These are procedure matters. They're not matters of conscience. Because I've been doing this for 4 years, much to my distress. It's not good that somebody else can
read it.
But I know the terrain, process wise. The second issue is Momo keeps insisting. It is not negotiation. Why would somebody come and talk with me if there's no prospect for negotiation? Right? He can use that word. As far as I am concerned, I can't speak for the culture. It is a negotiation. And there is an attempt to give and take. However, ultimately, the Treasury will not concede on anything it doesn't agree to withdraw. What we have found as a committee, speaking for the majority, is that Treasury is reasonable. They do give it, even though they make big noise here. Because nobody wants to pay taxes, right? Remember? No, you can never get agreement on tax, you can never get... We know all that, no more. The fact of the matter is, you are, as far as I'm concerned, you are negotiating with them. Now, thirdly, what we are saying is...
The other side is the other one side
is the Thirdly, what we are saying is, by the 8th, whether it's here or not here, by the 8th you must, or the 9th you must table the final outcome of your discussions that have occurred between now and then. Our first meeting on the Talent Bill will be on Wednesday, Wednesday the 17th is when we're going to look at the responses. And secondly, then finalize everything, and then you just go and print your book. But, Sandy and I, and Mr. Lee, I mean, meet and remit issue, we have already agreed on the subcommittee on the DAC issue. Sandy's new point is, if necessary, we should also have the same subcommittee deal with difficult issues if you don't achieve the necessary progress in time for the 8th. That's what we are saying. On the 8th when we come here, we begin with these for our, but at least it gives us a week to look at the documents and see that they are to. So how many times do you meet with the statement of the But she invites also, and I intend in the office of the chair to say, that look, that legal matter, that stuff is already with us. You guys can talk, but you know, there it is. It's the final hour. So we're on the same page. Long as they go.
Okay.
I will not say this on slides, but I might as well just say it now. Because I think the only other hearing that we then need, aside from any at the one, the legal issue, is we will come with the vet, the response by government. So whether we do it on the 8th or the 17th. So then, okay.
That's what we're talking about at the meeting.
Okay.
That's what you're going to be at the meeting in Yanga, and Mr. Mania will be there. Tommy and I, Mr. Mania, and you two will at the end here discuss the subcommittee footprint and things.
Okay. That's fine.
The second issue that we discussed yesterday, which is collecting the city of Fisher Rather than Akhmed from the community. Okay. The third one is clarification of the chapter 10 of South Sudan, whereby last year we gave the decision to them, so now we have to give the decision to non-ferry lenders and other taxpayers. And we propose that...
Mm-hmm.
not the law society. So we propose that we can't give non-bank lenders the same dispensation as banks, because banks are highly regulated and regulated. However, we said to non-bank lenders, you're going to have, instead of banks have got two stages, 25, 40% and 85. And then with regards to non-bank lenders, in the draft here we had only 25%. But now we are making changes to say we're going to have two stages of business, 25 and 40%. And those two other people business, that is the small business entities that are not business, they use age analysis of the debt. And they listen to 25% is the age of 60 days, and 40% is the debt is 120 days. And then there was an issue of those who received rulings from staff. And then we said that we want to do a transitional clause. But that said, we must know who has got rulings from staff and what does the rule say. So we're going to have a meeting next week. So those who have rulings must come to us and say these are the rules they are having, so that we are able to make an appropriate measure for the transition. So that is the second thing.
I know another reason is to raise an issue of how fast the
financial
system.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you want to
raise this question.
Madam Chair, thank you. National Treasury are kind of compromising on this issue, but the difficulty seems to be that syndicated SARs and getting all the what are they called, rulings, we are asking the taxpayer to come to National Treasury to put on the table what the rulings are. And so there are a number of possible difficulties here, is that how do you actually ensure that all the people who have had rulings are aware that you want them to put those before you? And in what format would those rulings be put? Because as I understand it, and maybe be able to characterize, when you apply for a ruling, you motivate for the ruling, and then it's either granted or not, but it's applied. You don't actually get back from SARS some kind of certificate, or, as I understand it, and I might be wrong, that now a taxpayer can bring to National Treasury if he has my copy of the ruling from SARS, as opposed to this was my application to SARS. So France is shaking his head, so I'm probably wrong, so he can clarify on that. And so I would have thought that it would be better for SARS to produce all the rulings, and then National Treasury has them, and the taxpayer can challenge if SARS haven't given the rulings or something like that. I'm just concerned about the process.
So, to the first point, taxpayer comes in check. So, we have a difficulty in providing taxpayer information. Treasury needs to identify the taxpayer. So, I think this was Treasury's practical way around that particular bar. Clearly, what you do is have the taxpayer give permission to SARS to give them, but then you understand you can the longer one needs. The second point about what you get back from SARS, in this context, I think what you're thinking about more are directives, where people are getting a power from the pension and then SARS gives you a response if you've not approved. This is a somewhat different process. It's a ruling process. It's a pipe ruling. Some of these are quite old, so they predate the formal rules process that we have. And so there you would have got a response back from SARS saying you are interested to have or doubt the debt allowance of this, and that would be a letter back to you.
He raises the question of the process, how long unfolds for a taxpayer to come to the point where they understand the question.
So, I think practically speaking, so to the point of will get everybody coming to court to prove it, I doubt it. But clearly you will have the people who are most affected to the country. We've already heard from him in this room that they've taken trouble to come to this meeting. So, I think Treasury will have a good dipstick of what the outlier is. SARS may have been the least generous rulings, but actually you're most concerned about what the most generous rulings were as opposed to what is currently being proposed. And the Treasury will then have that listing that they can use to decide what kind of transitional rulings are required.
Are we all
Madam Chair, yeah, I hear what Franz is saying, but I also hear what Young is saying is that next week we're having this meeting. There's no way that taxpayers can get reactive costs. I'm sorry, Young, but that's asking too much. And then just on the confidentiality thing, in order to assist National Treasury, would SARS not be able to inform the people that have given rulings to that they need to produce the rulings for National Treasury? That doesn't break any confidentiality.
It does.
Rather than SARS giving the rulings to a third party, in this case being National Treasury.
Can you explain what the for the purpose of this meeting, because we've debated this issue quite some time, just to refresh his mind what is it and then he will understand why the confidentiality clause came in when we were in Room B227 on a specific case which we all wanted to deal with, but we were prohibited by this particular clause.
Before he comes in, let me sum up what I think he will say. They can tell us nothing.
Madam Chair, I'm not asking them to tell National Treasury, I'm asking them to communicate with the taxpayer directly, where there's no confidentiality.
So, part of your difficulty is the period of time over which the meetings are taking. So, it's going to be quite difficult for us to go back into the archives and pull out all of these readings. But again, a similar problem to what you're saying, putting on the table for the taxpayers, we would have a similar problem. We have to be in the archives, go and find the rulings, then we have to communicate with the taxpayers. To the question of taxpayer confidentiality, a taxpayer is always free to waive confidentiality. So if we were to invite the taxpayer to waive the confidentiality to Treasury, it's up to the taxpayer to decide whether to do that or not. In this space, the practical consideration of finding all the rulings going back in time, because that particular provision, which is discretionary, has been enacted by 1942. So you could have quite a deep archive in this country.
Can we put a timeline as to which ones you can get so that you don't go back in time in relation to what you have to achieve with
that? What happened to that check? In our draft deal that was published in July, we did not have a transit language. So they came with us during the comment stage. So those who came to us during the comment stage said they have rulings. So people who have rulings, they've already come to us. So and during the workshop, I'd like to say that it will be difficult for us to put an appropriate transition measure if we don't know what the rulings are. So if we can see it at the workshop, bring us an example of the rulings that you are having, so that we are able, as far as today, to be able to gauge like what can we do in terms of the transition measure.
Madam Chair, I misunderstood the process. I'm sorry, Bianca. My understanding was every ruling had to be produced next week. Then that's it. Thank you for your
care. But it's in a principle that we make sure that we look into those rulings, even if they don't go back in time. Because once you have a ruling, and you don't know the type of ruling that is there, that's not an issue. I'm not proposing an additional clause, but maybe through
yes, because I look at the rulings, but now, during the workshop, on the guidelines of discussions, you find that other taxpayers are using rulings issued to other taxpayers. So the purpose of the read now, we may not get that number.
And the collective speech has been up to that level.
It might be worth, I think, one of the things the Rubin Commission that I understand is looking at is the issue of confidentiality. So for example, the way SARS does procurement or gives a contract to bank, you can't say that expects confidentiality, okay? So I'm saying that one needs to look at how to get accountability.
Maybe that's for you, what you just said, sir.
Yeah. And I think, so maybe even this is an issue which I think we do need to unpack more, that what's in the public interest comes up. I believe the taxpayer is not named, etc. But perhaps these are areas that are advanced in terms of going forward.
Okay, I hope everybody knows who actually is fighting, because we fight it would have been a big mistake.
That's part of our contract.
So, Chair, I mean, you put your finger on a difficult question we often have to try and resolve, which is that, and I use the term good, very loosely here, but even good tax planning strategy usually has a commercial use as well. It gives you a colour of legitimacy when you do it. So there are uses for different classes of shares, whether to stratify your risk in a particular portfolio. So that's all understood. But you can also use it for other purposes, and I think that's where Melvin may be coming in a point or two. But we have this problem elsewhere. The classical example is the so-called captive insurance company, where we have rules that the control foreign company rules, which are aimed at bringing passive and tainted income back into the program. So the way you would break those rules classically was you then create a company with multiple shares of different classes of shares. So if you looked at the whole picture, it wasn't a connected party, the controlled foreign company rules couldn't come into play. But if you looked at a particular class, then it was very clearly a connected party for that segregated little chunk of business. And so you tick the legal box, but the practical box had a big cost of it. And that's the kind of thing that you can experience when you do these classes of shares. I must admit, personally, when I see classes of shares, my ears prick up immediately because of the risk that is inherent in it. But again, as I said, there are legitimate uses for it as well.
I'll tell you where my suspicion emanates from. I suspect Sale of Envy International did that with staff. That's how we issued the class of shares to the South African counterpart to try and circumvent. I don't have that information because they've not yet presented the financial statement and so on. But that's my suspicion, basically. And Ronel, you might guide us to answer that.
Thank you, Chair. As Frank is correct, there are valid reasons for using different types of shares in the BDC structure. However, what we have found is that we have identified in the taxpayers are now using the different types of shares to drain profits from the target company, the qualifying company. Where, for instance, you find where an investor already had a share in a long existing company, and all companies are doing well, so, and they would like to expand that company. So what they would do, for instance, is that they would carve out a certain business from the bigger group and sell that business to a new company, which they now call a target company. And then that company will then issue shares to that investor. And that investor will then qualify for a BTC incentive where they shouldn't, because that was not the purpose of the BTC. So that's just one of the examples that you look to the description.
Maybe we need to case by case, I don't know how. I should just not ask it.
Yeah, Chair, I think that this has been a hugely abusive scheme. And National Treasury have come to a possible solution. We won't know really until there's the application and we see how it works. So I would suggest that we go ahead with it as it is, and we need to stop the abuse. So to make it applicable next year, to me, doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense, because you've got another 6 months of abuse to take place. So, but I'm also opposed to backdating. So we've got to find a date that actually doesn't break the sort of rules about backdating and also stopping the abuse. Now the suggestion is that the date the draft bill was published, I think. The date of tabling. So that date's yet to come. Okay. So there's still a bit of a gap for people to rush in and abuse the system. But be that as it may, I think the general consensus that it's been abused needs to be shut down as quickly as possible. But there are reasons why different classes of shares
a normal business trend. And so there, it seems to be a compromise about that.
Yes, I don't know the situation where it's what you have determined how investors have classified their product, and they claim that they lost business because of how you wanted them to classify the structure of their shares. Because that can lead to the case. So we need to also look at the unintended consequence in terms of what, as we try to stop abuse and then also build up to the legislative burden with that. Just want to review how they do it. So that's why I said, in the internal baby, so basically, you say, we therefore agree so that we investigate any event that we suspect any wrong. I don't know how it should be.
The 1950 year was the sunset clause of 2021, because it was an incentive, so we put a sunset clause. So come 2021, going to review the whole incentive. So we are left now with 2021, and then that's when we can review and see if we can continue the one incentive or continue on the different
that. That's a compromise procedure.
I think it's just from talking.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just maybe to correct something, or maybe there's a misunderstanding with regards to the terms of reference of the Nugent inquiry. Looking at the terms of reference, nothing covers the tax on it. So the terms of reference relates to the governance and all those other issues within SAS, and whether it is possible to change the reporting lines and the like. But it's got nothing to do with the tax ombuds. The tax ombuds have certainly testified only in relation to the refund report. So with respect, I think maybe this is where there's a point of departure, and the judge is concerned that the reasons that have been provided to him for not incorporating the request are not, he is not satisfied with the reasons. In fact, he feels that they are not relevant to, because the request that is being made is just to change a few ways, I'm sure about 3 or 4 ways in the existing mandate. So that's, and the judge insists that I should just make sure that if that is corrected, if it is not understood correctly.
As I said earlier, I like the enthusiasm of the ombudsman. The fact that they are looking into these issues, there's no difference between us on the changes to be made. But I think it may be technically correct that the tax ombudsman system is not specifically referred to in the terms of governance. But if you look at the terms of governance, I mean, it's looking at issues of capacity tax yes, the governance arrangement. We think that all of this will have an impact on the role of the tax ombuds office. In fact, it may be strengthened even more than what the tax ombuds request. And as I said, there's been, certainly when we were there at the hearing, the issue of an inspector general versus tax ombuds also came up. It was raised by Judge Davis. So, and if you look at Judge Davis's report, he does have a whole proposal on the ombuds office, which is different to the current model that we have. So the commission is and has been asking to what extent is Judge Davis's report, which covers a lot of these issues. I mean, we thought they'll only focus on Chapter 1 of the Tax Amendment Report, which is focuses on governance, the way the Commission and so on is appointed. So, you know, and look, I think, you know, the Minister and the Judge are engaged, and and I would hope that that's where this issue can be laid. And it's just an issue of time. When do we make the change? I can see that that somebody is in a hurry to get one clause amended that they can do systematic reviews without the approval of the Minister of Finance. That was a change that we brought in. And that's the only issue. So I don't know, should we wait for the Newton report or should we make that change and then wait to make other changes? I think that's the risk. Even though it's not formally in the edit, but I think there's a good likelihood of it. I may be wrong, there's a good likelihood that I think Judge Newton will comment on more than just governance, and I think we look at the role of various institutions to ensure that there's no abuse within staff, the type of abuse that we see, including around that.
Madam Chair, if there's no more haste from National Treasury, perhaps the DA should introduce the private members' bill.
Okay, colleague, our existing position is that we want the tax on this person to be spent. The tax on this to be spent, right? It is in a report, I don't know which report, Alan, the last year. So that is our policy, right?
You can't. But not independence, just explain.
No, it's very independent, obviously. No, given the experience we had over the last.
No, I just remind
you of what our position is. So, we are very clear, our position is on greatly independent, great expense. There's no, unless that policy is changed, that is the policy, Momo. Then the issue arises, do you want to do it in a piecemeal way, or do you want to do it with a new commission, whether it in fact explicitly addresses that or not, it will address governance issues as a whole. So even if it doesn't address your specific concern, the other issues it addresses, they will bring some insights into how we might restructure your office and make it stronger and more independent. About the Inspector General position, this is the first time I hear, I don't know how the union is doing it, but it's a new idea. That also means we have to apply our mind, how would an Inspector General relate to the ombudsperson, right? Then there's the issue of, from what I can gather, Davis has got some ideas on how your current ombuds office should be structured along. Those are big issues, which makes me feel comrade chair, that we should just reaffirm in our current report to Parliament we want independence, greater strengthening, blah, blah, we can do that. And then as soon as possible, after the Nugent Commission of Inquiry completed its work, we ask the Executive, obviously we invite the Nugent Commission here, to consider appropriate amendments. That's one way forward, but that's not a view of the Committee. I'm telling you, coming from the views of the Committee, this might be a way forward that meets your concerns and that also meets their concerns. That's all I'm saying. But whatever the majority says, I'll go by that. What I don't need any discussion about, I must come back, they now report, we want greater independence, take it
there.
No comment necessary on the VCCs, I think. You know, I think with the just move forward on it, yeah.
Okay, that brings us to the end of the discussion on the GFL. Thank you all for coming now. You want to speak on it? No, there is a big time.
So we're not going to go through and say these are okay, these we're still going to do that.
So just a quick overview to be thinking about now that we've done it all, you can help us just think about what we do.
There's two ways to do it. We obviously have the response stock, okay? Or I think it is in the slides, and there are other slides here. You could just look at that and see if you, if the committee is broadly happy.
But the underlying
document is a draft response stuff that we've written. So the slides are just summarized. So I don't know, we can look at the slides or the document.
On point five. That's the percentage of it. Is it always this? I've got it wrong.
No, I'm thinking the percentage is down for the that's a down for the percentage. The point five relates to consequentials of last year's substantive changes to the debt relief rule, because we shifted from looking at the viewpoint of the data to looking at the viewpoint of the creditor, whether the debt is scheduled to get adequate consideration. So when we had that policy shift last year, there were consequential and practical matters to take into account. The primary one was the issue around changes in the terms and conditions of a debt, because that's where you get your claim with subordination agreements, where you give a taxpayer a break from making payments and only making interest payments and so forth. Or really just reducing the ranking in terms of the creditors' ranking or the other creditors. So what we've done this year, especially around that issue, was that we focus the rules on realization events, so basically when a debt is actually settled. So the changes in the terms and conditions of the debt, we have backtracked on that issue. Because primarily in some instances, you will enter into a subordination agreement at the behest and requirement of a third party borrower, who will, the lender bank, who will require the connected party debt, the shareholders and subsidiary debt, be subordinated in favor of the bank debt. So those were those practical issues that we basically came to the table with industry with to rectify those narrow the rules so that those types of compromises are not within the debt. Because here we're primarily looking at intercompany debt. But in some instances, I think you're sole proprietors, you have to look at that. But that's actually more a consideration that a third party lender would look at. So your bank would have to be more cognizant of that. So the way we've done our rules is basically to not tamper with those types of requirements that a bank would have. I think put them in a much better position so not to get muddled in that space.
How does
the 5
is a partial reduction of
this? Okay. With regards to a partial reduction of this, those are more technical arguments we were having. And during the workshop, what came to light was that it seems it's more of a preference in drafting down, because what we had with the previous rule was sort of like a calculation-based rule, where you said, okay, you have a reduction amount where the reduction of the debtor's debt, right, after taking into account whether he has paid something. The rules now look at the actual event. So whether there is a cancellation of debt, whether there is a reduction of debt, or a waiver of the debt. Okay. So when you get into a situation where between the debt and the creditor, the creditor is okay, in order for us to just get to the end of this, you can pay this difference in the rent. In a simple example, you pay half of that debt. So you can't say any part of that half that has been paid has been cancelled or waived. So the only the part that you have actually have not made a payment for can you say has been paid or waived. So by implication, we explain this. You will only look at the amount of debt that you still owe, and all of a sudden, at the end of the day, it has vanished. So part settlements don't specifically need to be provided for, because the trigger for now for the rules is the part where it's still outstanding, but you haven't really done anything to settle it. So the shift of the focus is shifted. So I guess it's a matter of now going back and applying your mind to shift in the policy and the trigger point for the rule. We are of the view that we don't have to have a specific wording that says a cancellation or waiver for no consideration. A cancellation or waiver would basically mean that you have not paid any
consideration.
May I just say something on that point? David Warnick on behalf of SAICA. Just that the wording in the case of a partial reduction on a technical level doesn't seem to quite cater for what you're trying to achieve there. That was really the point.
My question is, in the case of a partial reduction, I mean, the part of the day, whatever mechanism you choose to set it aside, can you, after that segment or that part of it, can it really be said it's been cancelled or waived or redeemed or converted into something else?
Look, we're getting into technical points now. Maybe we should be on that one. Take all time, does it?
Yes, you do come up with that for us.
Yeah. Look at that. Let me do that. I'm going to rely on you.
We need to call the email. Yes.
We're
finding anti-avoidance for meeting the shape of anti-avoidance. The dividend stripping is still an issue. The dividend stripping still seems to be an issue.
So the dividend stripping issue is also an issue in part from last year's amendment. So in last year's amendment, we broadened the rule that existed at that point on when we would actually make an exchange dividend an amount of income or proceeds on a disposal, a subsequent disposal of shares. So it's now been broadened to the already existing extraordinary dividend definition. So in substance, what you're trying to do is try to claw back any sort of exempt dividends that were distributed before a share disposal, which then results in us collecting less on the disposal because you strip the share of its value. So, the area of contention was the situation where you subsequently dispose of those dividend stripped shares by way of your organization transactions, so your tax deferred transactions, which are allowed in the Act. So last year, what we had then done was that we said the dividend stripping rules override the tax deferred transactions. So basically, they sought to nullify the deferral and trigger an immediate clawback on the disposal. What we've now done, and this is where the discourse comes in, is the technicality and difficulty of the rules that we have. Because we are trying to cater within an anti-avoidance measure of numerous other provisions. Okay, so there is a layering up. So the main comment coming from the changes we've tried to make, because what we're trying to do is defer the effect, the clawback, not on your first deferral transaction, but on a transaction after a deferral transaction when you then dispose of the shares outside of your economic unit. But it has resulted in cumbersome rules, which are difficult, and we conceded to that and said, well, we'll seek to break down the different scenarios within the legislation in order to make it more understandable for everybody. there were issues about there being an effective 36-month period that the rules apply. But during our discussion, I think everybody was of the view that it's a competitive rule, that you don't actually see what 18-month period you're dealing with, because you're dealing with an 8 to 18-month period. You're dealing with an 18-month period where you look back before you do a disposal transaction at the amount of dividends that you received during that 18-month period. So that is a more of a determination period, right? And what we're seeking to do, and this needs to come through here, more clear in the rules, is that after that disposal transaction, in the next 18 months, that is where we could potentially throw back on the dividends in the past 18 months. So what we want to do is not to have this restart of the redetermination of the 18 months when you apply the rule, but look at the dividends that were displayed during 18 months before disposal, and then try to then have the speed bump of 18 months applied only to those ones, right? And then look at the next period, not have a speed bump, so that it seems that there's a continuous period where you, once you've done a dividend strip, you're already always in the NTL window. That's not what we want.
Yeah. I believe there's a coming to industry. I see something different, and I'm going to use the style of argument. The reason why the financial statements were not doing that on time, I believe they're trying to circumvent the deferral.
I know I'm being.
I have preconceived ideas in relation to what happened in relation to time, but my suspicions are more on the issues of avoidance to pay independent debt. Now, if you're saying that you will only draw back 18 months after when it's now in 36 months, you should be having a principle rule that if you find that there's no other deferral, there must be a pinch of clause that kicks in. I don't know.
I hear you, ma'am. But the main consideration that was taken into account, I'm trying to, because I don't think the industry is happy with these changes in any case, right? I'm not saying that they throw them out, but I think we try to find a more workable solution to apply to the regulation. In some instances, the rules in and of themselves result in an extraordinary dividend, so basically a trigger of these rules. Like say for an unbinding transaction or for a liquidation distribution. Basically, those transactions are either in of themselves extraordinary distribution. So what we're trying to get at is trying to get to a solution where you could have an extraordinary distribution, right? But for as long as what your distribution results in is not one party getting the dividend and the other party ending up with the asset, and a lower value asset, okay, that you acquire a lower value and will collect tax on. So for
everybody, they end up with a lower value asset in the American transaction. I don't want to pull this discussion. I'll just bring you to the attention because that's exactly what happened. That's how they acquired the lower value asset. That's why I said to Marcus, you said you made a bad investment decision. And we did not know what was the intention, whether they were going to reshape it and unbundle at a later stage. I don't know that. You can only do that when you have seen later that there was a deferral, which is 36 months down the line. I'm not saying get involved in a cumbersome process, but you know, because you've got technical that's fast to do this work, and I'm not doing that. But I'm saying, let's look at it from different perspectives and see what are the intentions in this context.
Madam Chair, can I assume then that this is a work in progress?
Just make another point. At the public hearings meeting that was held, you asked SICA to propose wording for the text. So we have sent that through last night, and we believe that it does address the fact that if you have subsequent, after you've done your dividend strip, and then there then is a corporate relief transaction, and we have successive corporate relief transactions, each time that 18-month period is reset, we think we've addressed and solved that problem. And then also the one anti-avoidance scheme that was addressed there, which we don't think, which adds a lot of the complexity to that provision, we, you know, for the reasons that we've said, we don't believe it's commercially viable actually for a person to undertake. And therefore we've proposed that be, that problematic part of it. So we've sent that through for consideration, that proposal.
I just wanted to put the record that the anti-avalanche scheme that they are saying is not possible. Last year, they wanted us to make changes, they put that scheme through. They just said,
Okay. Let's do it this way. Let's look at that clause. That's been proposed. And then, you'll understand what I'm doing, but I'll explain to you later. And then, this one that you give him much to interest, because I'm saying it happens. Particular. That's why there was a company that was both in America that was a bad investment. And he actually he didn't even realize where I was going. I was addressing issues of tax avoidance, but I didn't say it when I asked him that question. And he asked it. And he answered my question without me saying, were you avoiding tax when you're doing certain things in my country? But I'm saying, we're trying to find an applicable solution because there's also a business argument that is being raised. We'll look at and weigh how the text will try to meet everybody. For now, let's not go there. Shall we note it?
Shall we note
it? Thanks. May we proceed, please?
Could I put my hand up there? I mean, I'm the person who drew Treasury's attention to that particular transaction. So it was me. So I'm putting my hand up there and I'm saying that I did that, and it was putting a memo together on theoretically this is how it could be done. I did neglect to say that commercially it actually wouldn't be possible because I didn't quite frankly apply my mind to that. So, could I just finish what I'm saying? The concern is that the rules and the transactions acknowledge that the rules are incredibly complex. There are, and I'm, as the extra
of the treaty. I don't want to discuss the rules and all that. I said, let's look at that. We find a way of finding each other. We don't take away the other facts about how people are unbundled and defend and make it very cumbersome for society. We find each other on how to make things commercially viable. So let's not get into that space now, because this text, we don't have it. We have not considered it. We don't know what the national treasurer's view on it. So at what point do we discuss? Do we discuss it now? We have not empowered with it, we have not listened, we have not applied, I myself have not applied my mind, and so on. So that's what we want to do now. It's not, you know, I now I understand what you did in that workshop, and I don't want us to do it here. we're trying to make it work.
Can I say one thing? The rules are unreadable as they are. They actually, you cannot read it. They're just not, they're not understandable. And all we're asking for is a clear set of rules that people can understand and apply. That's all we're asking for. That's not, I mean, that's...
They have to ask the lawyers to write those rules, or who are these more... You're going to make it easy for everyone. You think we cannot allow you to bring that headache of yours to be ours.
Yeah,
but at least we'll know what, where they stand, all of that. And then we'll also apply the minds on it. So if we're taking the manner in which I still need to think this, I always say I'm slow, but I will need to think this. and I accept it. I'm very, very slow. So we'll see the tax. But you take into consideration what they are using. Yeah, she's a lawyer, so that's the problem. She likes to very taking that way. She is. She's a lawyer. Yeah, she's a lawyer. So this is
an accountant.
You hear the problem of lawyers, and then we'll sort it out, and then we keep it. And, you know, we don't have everything like that.
I agree with you, Madam Chair. We would have been not this far. Just not seeing how it is, Madam Chair. I think there's general agreement between the various parties, and that's great. But there,
is it clear, sorry,
what's going to happen? And solutions are proposed. Isn't there one, I'm not actually sure about this thing myself, isn't there something that's called
On CIS, you agreed that you're going to withdraw the proposal for now, so you're not going to have the section 25A amendment. But that said, you're going to have working groups, and then anything that comes from those working groups, one more time, you're going to put it in the next year, the budget next year. You're not going to have to put it.
Madam Chair, I have my thoughts now, but that's where I understand it. But isn't there the basis of what's going to go into the budget surely requires a policy? And is that policy position today?
That's yet. We are proposing that we work towards the policy position during this remaining period.
Okay. You know why he's asking this question? Because it never comes through the process of the HVP and then it gets discussed. You know, we are going back to that debate. So
we also, after the election, we postpone to the
Madam Chair, what Momo then is assuming that none of us are coming back?
No, Momo knows that some of us don't want to come back. You see, that's the thing.
Madam Chair, the next one is the doubtful debt, and I hear the concession made, adding the additional category for non-banking. But I think that there's a conflation of issues here. To conflate the fact that there are other regulations that control banks as a reason why the treatment of doubtful debts should be different, I'm not sure that I buy that clearly. I don't see. Can you explain to me what? Forget about how the institutions are regulated. What is the negative? What do you see as possibly a negative impact of giving the same dispensation to banking or non-banking? What would, as opposed to, you know, they're not regulated, what would be the negative consequence?
The person, it's very easy to become a credit lender. There's no prudential regulation to another bank. And in fact, some of our problems of investors are directly from many firms that are operating in this space. So I think we want to make sure that a lot of those companies, I think, need to be dealt with from a regulatory perspective, and some of the activities, I think, need to be simply not allowed.
That's a regulation.
That's a regulation issue. The way we have to discriminate that is to what, I mean, obviously, the way banks are prudentially regulated, their whole treatment of debt is an important matter where the regulators look at it to look at how solvent they are. If you are a man, and from what I can see on the non-banks, I mean, obviously there's a lot of insurers coming to that space, but they are regulated, I think, quite intrusively and intensively. If you look at even the car lenders, okay, you know, they just need it's not even a heavy licensing process. It's a very easy process to get the approval to. And even there are market conduct practices which I hope now will be taken up. For example, you know, before you could only ban for 5 years, now I think it goes up to 6 or 7 with balloon payments and X. So even there are practices that we don't like. Now, to the extent that they have proposed their debts, I don't think anybody really looks at whether they've got doubtful debts from a regulatory perspective. So the incentive for bank, I think, to try and jibble the system will have implications for them on the regulatory side, which won't be there for your non-bank lenders. So I think that we need to get the regulatory regime right. They can't say they're the same as banks. They don't buy that story. They do need to be more inclusively and intensively regulated in the market conduct. Yes, banks are not regulated on market conduct, they are regulated on convention. But that's why the regulators, I mean, really do afford us the kind of context that there's limited scope to gain the system, but there will be regulatory issues for the banks, which doesn't apply to the non-bank lenders. If the insurance company, sure, it may come up, but they don't fall under banking on the insurance, certainly they're not covered. So I think we, I in fact think these provisions are too generous. But we can live with that.
Actually, remember, simply because what the National Credit Act was trying to do with the amendment, what they were actually trying to do, what both the informal and the formal lenders are doing with the regulated lending. So this put us actually in tension to that process. So we shouldn't find ourselves trying to change what the National Credit Act is trying to achieve in terms of regulated lending and introduce a system that's going to because the measurement tool that is being used to determine whether a person qualifies for a loan, it was just a tick box process and not necessarily looking at being a real need. So I followed the discussion very closely yesterday in the house because it related to what we're trying to achieve through this. So probably we need to explain more, I don't know, to other members, what these lenders have been doing, give examples of the market for you to understand what triggers this to the effect which we are trading.
You also notice my favorite company, Walmart.com, is no longer there. And part of it is the regulators became really tough on them in the UK. To expose their market conduct to users and so on. So I think, I'm just saying that we need to make sure the system doesn't favor them in any way to continue with our bad market conduct. But I think the point is to be understand. And I think, Chair, this has been an issue, not just on this issue, but we do need to obviously satisfy what are the regulatory issues and deal with them through the regulatory mechanism and not use a tax system. But that aside, I think here this is just the scope of use, just given that they're not, you know, the fact that banks really, they can default the system like we saw with VDS and so on, it's not impossible. But it's much harder, I think, for banks to kind of deceive us, I think. There is some way that we check on the way they provision for doubtful debts, which is an important measure, the whole NPL. I mean, our measure that's inherent to banking. The other credit lenders, it's not, because they don't take deposits. They don't use money to pay for mortgages and so on.
Madam Chair, I think that the point is made and Murray is explaining it as it is. So, you know, I mean, a tax method being used to fill a regulatory gap at this stage, as I, to
student. And so if the regulations were there, we wouldn't need this. And it's not likely the regulations are going to be as tight as the bank ever, I should think.
Yeah, but I still want to be careful in saying that if even the regulations were there, we would not be that generous with one bank. But we hope with Tim Pete, the regulatory side will also kind of help to deal with some of the market conduct and prudential issues of these non-bank lenders.
The regulatory gap has been so specific, the way that arrangement was made in the house. And it has been there since 2005. And I'm speaking within my PTI gap.
So the distinction between bank debt and debt.
Yes. I'm saying the regulatory gap has been closed. The tax instrument is still blocked up until there's been discovered that existing activity has taken place. So I just want to say, you need to explain more. I'm not able to.
Just the last one, Madam Chair, the cryptocurrency transaction, the definitions there, are you guys not prepared to talk any more about definitions? Nyanga's shaking her head. Mm-hmm. I mean, your comment is pretty clear, but it's going to be us in the committee going to build a final bill canvas to have to deal with it.
Chair, we don't even use words like cryptocurrency, crypto assets. Not a currency. Just alive on the regulatory side, yeah.
It's your job to get
that. I know. I got to make sure that we also get rid of this language that's out there.
Okay.
I should remind you that the Reserve Bank governor was here. We agreed that even though our terms of market end, this is going to be here for some time. We needed a whole day workshop. We'll invite you to discuss what all these terms mean. Mm-hmm. You know, legal technology. You know, because I go to the Parliamentary Network Conference, that's where I talk about it. It's a hell of a difficult thing, cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, all of that, and so on, right? And this is what I think the committee. So basically, we agreed the first on the coming.
That's
okay. After we say about the socialization of the forces of production, after the conflict between the forces and the relations of production, you know what the motto of history is? Now, what I'm saying, probably just to remind ourselves and our two secretaries, we said in the first week we come back in next quarter, the quarter of 2019, the first quarter, we are going to have all day with these issues.
Yeah.
That's all.
That brings us to the edge of the 11 items. Any other issue, members? No?
It's just one political thing that we need to raise, right? Now, I'm going to be clear about this more. We have to ask them. As far as we're concerned, nothing's changing in the current regime of foreign funds. And all that's happening is an extension because of the process. So what we don't want is what we went through before. We're about to vote on the bill, and then there's a huge blowout for the trade union movement who are fed up with us anyway. So where's that?
That's the issue of extending the fact that frozen funds can still enjoy the tax deduction, but not a new time. No, that's what is going to bring the bill to extend, because that falls away.
And the trade unions are fine with it.
Well, let's put it this way. The trade unions that are participating in that tax, there are trade unions that are not. There's a report that's coming, Chair. It's just going through all the signing loop process, that is agreement with the
I want to say that why can't we ask that the report be tabled so that it's on the record?
No, no, we'll bring the agreement once it's signed. We will.
But before we vote?
Yes, yes, we
are
voting.
Yeah.
Thank you. I don't know which would she have to the judge just for the judgment of the judge the
So we are looking at that.
Additionally, transfers to a spot are already fully identified stages, although the data tax and key report says that we should remove that, but that is being reviewed. There was another comment just saying that the higher rate of the safety of 25% will identify compliance from South Africa, and the other question whether it would be able to implement it due to the administrative capacity of the master office inside. Our view is that this shouldn't actually change any of the administrative processes behind getting a KGT because it's only a rate change. So you have to do the full process of getting working out your estate with the market office anyway, and then right at the end, it's only the calculation that changes, so it shouldn't be a change. There's also comment that if consideration should be given to a wealth tax to contribute to the fiscal and the social justice of the past, which may be simpler than a KGT. But we do recognize that the DTT report has done reports and wealth taxes that we are currently reviewing. Although from that initial report it does look as if wealth tax would be simpler than a KGT, it would also be quite complicated. Other comments were on excise duties on tobacco and alcohol. The one comment was that the 60% increase isn't going to have a large impact on tobacco consumption, as the excise duty and VAT remain around 50% of the price. So they say that evidence suggests that if you wanted to really limit the consumption of tobacco, that you should increase the incidence to around 70% of retail selling price. And that's been an argument for tobacco alcohol. So we're not necessarily proposed to increase this, but we do have a very stable environment where we do try and target the incidence. And if we were going to make a big change, we would do a full review of the products. Other comments are that additional revenues should be channeled towards health promotion and preventative efforts. So generally, we don't like to ring-fence amounts from the tax, but we have been making soft earmarking where we provide additional funds that have been made available through normal budgeting process for national partners for health promotion. That is especially true in the case of the health promotion. There are additional comments on the retirement lump sum taxes to say that you shouldn't be progressive and just impoverished workers, and they propose a different setup. So we do have two different tables on the lump sums that you get from a retirement fund. So if you would take the money out of your retirement fund for retirement, we are more punitive. The table is quite a bit harsher. So at the bottom it caps at about 18% to about 25,000, and then it does progressively get higher. This is in an effort to disincentivize people taking their money before they get to retirement. Once you get to retirement, we have a much more generous tax table, and we did a very large increase in the very bottom bracket from 350,000 to 500,000. So now, if you keep your money in your retirement fund and you get to retirement, the first 500,000 that you take will be tax-free. And we really do think that that has lowered the impact on lower income retirees. There was another comment you might remember, I think he comes to the committee quite often, on about the use of land taxes, and the view is that government should be phasing out income tax, corporate income tax, and value-added tax, and replacing it with the land use tax. Because it will not support economic activity to the same degree. So National Treasury does recognize the potential improvements in efficiency from land taxes. But OECD has actually done quite a lot of work that shows that land taxes are very efficient. You can't take land offshore. It's seen as a proxy wealth tax. So people get concerned about wealth taxes because you can just move your money offshore, move it offshore. If you tax land, you can't move the land offshore. Very immobile asset. And because of that reason, it is seen as to be a very efficient tax. And the OECD actually think it is more of an efficient tax than value-added tax. It also is the case that land may increase in value due to taxpayers' money being spent on improvements in infrastructure in nearby areas. And so I suppose you could look at things such as the Gautrain, and the Gautrain and that big infrastructure was built, then the land values around that infrastructure increase. And there is some theory pushed by Henry George, economist ages ago, to say that in effect that increase in the land value should be taxed by government to recoup some of their expenditure.
So we're doing a lot of research on this. We've been holding and attending workshops to explore this topic. It's quite difficult because of the intergovernmental arrangements that need to be explored. At the moment, national government doesn't raise revenue itself through any municipal property taxes or land taxes. It's done by the municipality. So there's some quite tricky and complicated arrangements that we need to think about. But we do admit that it could potentially improve the efficiency of the system and potentially act as a part of the wealth tax, but further research needs to be done.
The last one on this month, remember, in February, we issued draft regulations to private utilities. And we said that the amendments that are in the draft rate bill are consequential to those regulations. So in the rate bill, we propose that the effective date should be 1 October 2018. After public comment, that we had workshops on the 26th of May regarding this because we received comments. So it was proposed that we should postpone the effective date because Northern Centre staff need to adjust their system for implementation of this. So we propose that the effective date be moved to 1 April 2019. That effective date is not in the draft regulation, it's in the draft year. And the second thing was that because we are broadening the base, we think that everyone should register for e-services. We should consider increasing the threshold for registration from 50,000 to 1 million, similar to the domestic threshold for registration. So that's what we are proposing in the 2018 draft regulation. So these two will be included in the rate bill, but they will be related to the e-services draft regulation.
Chair, and then, in order to get to the rest one at the end, can I just also say that for the rates bill, just the VAT issues that are there, just the process, the way you see. Okay, so we're not dealing with that. But obviously, the change from 14 to 15% is dealt with that clause 9, section 7. And there's a whole lot of consequential amendments from 14 to 15%. The outstanding issue, of course, is the zero rating, which will be dealt with by amending Schedule 2, Part B of the VAT Act. So whatever the changes are, we'll be bringing it in the schedule when we table the legislation. Before we do that, we will have a response document of empowerment reconvened after 8 October, so we'll do it in that week or the week after. In fact, I think we'll do that and deal with any outstanding TLAB issues as well, if you like. And then we will table the bill on or before NCVPS. I'm saying on or before because I know that NCOP is also asking that we take that we don't wait for NCVPS. We don't have to wait for NCVPS. So we might just do the week or so before, but after we have the hearing with the committee and the response document on the back issues. Obviously there may also be in the response other mitigation measures on the expenditure side, which is also mentioned in the panel report. And you know that will have to come in future appropriation bills. We can certainly announce the intention, but the expenditure announcements may be reserved for the GPS sort of budget. We can go back. And then Chair, just quick review just to update you on the carbon tax bill as well. Because bear in mind, there too we've had public hearings, we've been through the response document. In addition to the response, I mean, so the bill is also ready to be tabled. We need to deal with the implementation date because obviously the 1st of January is not possible. But that's something that Minister cannot announced for the NCVPS or the budget for every day. And as requested by Scott, the issue that's outstanding is that we needed to go to MedLab to develop a jobs mitigation and creation plan. There's been really good progress made by the committee, and they did submit an initial progress report to Scott on 14th, which we could discuss. And this initial proposal for the plan will be presented by the constituency to the task team on 9th October. So they've had several meetings We could go by the interim report that's there. Next slide. And let me say that over and above the issues that we reached, I mean, some of the others with the response document, I think we'll have fairly positive news that we can go further on some issues, that there's full alignment between Department of Environment Affairs and National Treasury, between the carbon tax and carbon budget. So we really can, we're trying to scale and legislate that in the book. And arising from the comments that were made at that hearing, there'll be some more positive announcements as far as those who have requested an extraction of petrol and diesel, related emissions, taxation of domestic aviation, and waste-related emissions. Okay. So we are then ready to table this bill as well. So get to the last slide. Okay. So, Chair, we're hoping at MCGPS, you know, all these, or before, that all these bills just will be tabled. So whether it's taken up or not, I'm just saying, yeah, no, that's fine, because I'm just saying we'll be ready to be. Okay, so I think we're on track, and then we just got to watch the how much time the answer will be needed, because I know the Chair has been... Normally, they don't have much time, so I think they need to become conversation on how quickly these bills get passed up to the table by the Senate. Yeah, that's between the chairs. We need to... Okay, Chair, so that's it. All the things you should do.
I don't know what I'm going to do, but you just want to check the
I'm saying it's just a popular measure.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. So in terms of what the proposal is, then another 2 years of benefit for Providence Fund.
Yeah.
We should, 2 years is fine, but then we can pay the tax. I mean, I think it's an issue that needs to be up front for me to raise. No, it's just completely unfair to have two different regimes for I want you to win the election. Madam Chair, I really would like to ask your indulgence, if I may, and just go back to one point on the tax laws, which I left out. If I may, it's not on, that's why I left out, because it wasn't on the list. But it's with regard to the deregistration of tax practitioners. And just clarity, because I don't know what is really meant by compliance. So I'm an employer and I get the one rand for the two outstanding in my PAYE because there's an interest. I don't understand what the trigger points are to be non-compliant, and they're probably, as you look in the book, probably all laid out there carefully, so you can give those to me. And then the question also arises, what happens to the client of that tax? It's an automatic, as I understand it, deregistration, and suddenly you've got any number of who are their representative is no longer able to act for them. And yet the same kind of regime doesn't apply to attorneys and advocates and others who may not be tax compliant, may in fact be in court on some personal issue, and yet they can continue to run their practice. Perhaps this should apply to all. I'm not suggesting that that's not an argument, but I think it's a valid argument to argue that for how we're applying it to any one profession and not to other professions.
When we did speak about it, maybe we just kicked our minds. I remember telling them about what is about what we have given to the client. Maybe we have something.
Several questions wrapped up in there. The first one is around what is non-compliance, and what we've done is we've aligned that with the compliance requirements for tax and positive tax compliance status. So this is something that you can check on a day-to-day basis using your EPAR filing profile. We haven't tried to reinvent the wheel, and built into that compliance status are things like if the debt's less than 100 grand, it doesn't mean tax. So you want to automate the 300 pages of earning your bill. And also ensures that where the debt has been suspended by SARS, it doesn't apply to each. So all of those exceptions that exist in the tax compliance status exist for this purpose as well. So we've aligned to many things that we need to check. The question as to what happens to your client is really interesting. We rewind a little bit. The first question was, well, who's responsible for notifying the client? And logically, the practitioner is the only person who knows who all their clients are. So logically, it is the practitioner who has to let the clients know. There was some debate around that. Some people thought it should be SARS, but practically, the only way we could do that is by publishing the names of all the people, all the practitioners that had been dropped because of this. And the enthusiasm around that particular proposal was rather lacking, because it would seem that this would be an impact on their credibility going into the future and so forth. So it's very much going to have to be a practitioner. We do address it in the response document in some detail. Clearly, it's most difficult for someone who is a sole practitioner and finds themselves in this position. They have to find someone who can cover for them for the period that they're with the books. In a larger body where you have multiple practitioners working, well, then it's a bit easier because I can sort of pass it on to my colleague down the corridor. But that brings me to an important point. This is very far from an automatic process. the first thing we need to do is, once the conditions have been triggered, is notify the practitioner that they now have a period to come back to us to do one of two things. They either have to fix the long-term plan, so you haven't paid us for 6 months, so please pay us now. And the question would then raise, well, what if I can't pay you in one chunk? To which the response is, well, we have payment arrangements in the Tax Administration Act. Come up with a payment arrangement with us, and then one of the exemptions will trigger, you won't be non-compliant. So we've addressed that. Your other alternative is, and I think this was always implicit, but it's now very much explicit, is you can show SARS that you're in fact compliant. So we think you are owing us a debt, but in reality you sent us your request for suspension of the disputed debt. And somehow that wasn't processed, something happened to it, but you can show us definitively that you in fact have sent us that request for suspension. The way the law then works is, because you sent us a request for suspension, that automatically suspends the debt. You took us time to solve response to you, therefore you were not compliant, you in fact were compliant, and you're off the hook. So there's that process that we have to go through, and it's only if that process then doesn't come to a satisfactory resolution. You either fix the non-compliance, or you've shown us that you were compliant, that's fine. If you ignore us, if you continue non-compliance, then the sanction occurs. So it's not good that. Okay, so this will be some comfort there. And then we get to the sort of thorny question of one size, you know, should this be consistently applied across the board? Now, we do run into something of a problem with the fact that there is a great deal of difficulty in saying that an attorney as an officer of the court cannot practice. It speaks to issues of independence of the legal function in South Africa from the executive and the legislature. This was very much sharply put to the fore when we initially proposed a comprehensive regulatory system for everyone in the tax space. And those arguments were very forcefully put to us by the Law Society and the Bar. So that is why you do have the so-called statutory recognized controlling bodies and the non-statutory recognized controlling bodies in the framework at present. The thinking behind this was, let's try and see if this works. It's nothing of an experiment. If it becomes clear that this is a practical problem rather than a theoretical one, then we may have to revisit that comprehensive regulatory model. And if you go back to the expansion memorandum around the introduction of this particular model, like those points were made briefly in the expansion memorandum. So I certainly understand, you know, counting myself, that it's not desirable to have this slightly uneven playing field, but we've made it as even as we can, which is why, if you look at the provisions about lodging the complaints and so on, those are consistent across both types of RCB, recognized controlling body and statutory control. But there are some areas where there isn't perfect alignment, and unfortunately that is just the framework that we have at the moment. If we do try and fix that, it would be an interesting sort of debate that we would have around this table if we were to get into that comprehensive model, which Australia has done, by the way. So there's some interest in that.
But before we also, let's be careful not to discuss the extension of the memorandum, which is on the basis of a finance committee, to look at a comprehensive regulation of how you put sanctions in relation to different disciplines, because that's the duty of the Justice Committee and the Department to come with a legislative framework to extend a hand in terms of conduct of people in different practices. Because the discussion doesn't belong to a committee that deals with tax formality and all other things. It's about how, for instance, for argument's sake, how do you strip a doctor from their doctorate because of a tax offense? if we can, you know, things like that, if we can discuss that here, then they've got a different set of things in terms of how they follow procedure and even how you remove a magistrate from that. Because once you start to discuss a lawyer, equally then you must discuss a magistrate, a doctor and all that. And we don't even understand the principles of the expansion of memorandum in its current form here in our community. So I'll come to you on the I'll just say questioning as to not to find out that in that same basket.
Okay, I certainly take the points you made. It does put us in very difficult terrain. I do remember though that this would be restricted only to the tax sphere. To your point about the doctors, that's a very interesting one that you raised, because although we do not attempt to regulate, what we still can do, that's a controlling body. If you're talking a medical doctor, there's a controlling body for medical doctors. And if you read the provisions carefully, although you're not practicing in the tax space, and clearly SARS can't stop you practicing in the medical space, if you're doing something, say, for example, issuing fraudulent certificates of disability, or something of that nature, which has a direct impact on the tax rate, you have the power to report that to the relevant controlling body so that action can be taken by that controlling body. But that's as far as we can take it. We can't take it.
Yes, Mr. Ramadan, what power do we have to can we go to it?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Given all those constraints, Madam Chair, I assume then that an employee of SARS who is not tax compliant would be fired immediately.
Who are you talking about in this context? Yeah.
So that would be a huge process, sure. Because if you look at tax practitioners, it gives them an opportunity to the underlying point I think you're trying to make, I'll take that very seriously, and we do look at the tax compliance of our staff because we believe that it's important, as we expect everyone else to pay tax, so we should be tax compliant. So that is something that we do.
But sure, in this context, you must be aware and talk about the administrative justice. It was the law. There's a common law approach to any case of any individual at any given moment.
We don't want to have any kind of test. I don't know why you're pushing us to that level or
not. Just to make a point, I think that the concern is, and I hear what's being said by SARS, I think it is a concern that, SARS is not a perfect institution by any stretch of the imagination. I'm sure that they admit that themselves. So the concern I think is that if someone is said to be in default, they notify, they then respond, and at that point, if someone incorrectly says, well, we're not happy with your response, it can actually then threaten their livelihood, it can take their livelihood away from them. And I think that's the issue, that there's a concern that although there is that process that's got to be followed, that process might not be perfect and that errors might be made, which could then, because we're talking about a person's livelihood, that at the end of the day, your ability to earn your income from your practice.
But
the
people the reason why it was caused in Panama today is that they should be taken there and that this matter must be taken to the court of law. And they will pay for the losses of the individual in the event that they took a wrong administrative decision to steal them from practicing the tax position. So unless people are saying that legislative gaps that doesn't seek to protect a tax practitioner, well, the justice system is there, you're exactly there. I'm not sure what I was discussing, honestly. I'm not a lawyer. I don't want to be a lawyer today.
So I don't pretend to be a lawyer, otherwise I should play on the TV. But
The draft report you've got, can you send it to Adelaide Technology Center House? We have to adopt a resolution, which is a draft. I think show it to Frank. All three of you look at the draft you've got. Show it to Frank. By Monday, release the thing, and then we put some documents in. The committee has noted the report, and therefore involved, note it doesn't affect us very much, but make the following observations. And make some observations. So on the Wednesday, we will deal with the HLP report. We will take a resolution on that. But we'll also deal with all outstanding petitions. Okay, all outstanding petitions. I know there's one from Kostati. Not Kostati, Kostati. From pensions or something. All of those will be dealt with. The following week, Tuesday, that will be the 16th, right, Simon? 16th, we will actually have, I hope most listening will send it by Sunday. 16th, we will have the annual report of SARS and National Trade. On the 17th, I will send it all out. It's in my head partly, I'm discussing with Alan. 17th, we will then begin to look at the tax code. But, and this is where time is playing a very crucial role, I don't think we need to have a whole meeting there. I'm just saying that as well. We are very concerned that the Treasury might not concede enough on the Bureau of Prisons. So, it's your call when you publish the bill, but we're not just going to accept what Treasury gives. We might want more. In which case, I urge you not to publish your final version of the bill because it gets very complicated. The matter is highly political. Kandi and comrades from the ANC, we have no mandate on a big issue like this to decide on our standpoint. So it has to go to the caucus, right? Parliamentary caucus and the structure. But as I'm to hire, the same applies to Mr. Lee. He's the agreement I struck with him yesterday, he's done it, that he will signal to us what he sees at the moment, then he will discuss it with Mania, and they will go to their caucus. Right? But on this matter, also Mr. Mania, we can't just like take a position, it's too diminishing. Coming as it does, and a million other things I'm not going to cover the ground. So the carbon tax vote, I think it's unrealistic. The earliest you could start thinking of teaching it is when we proceeded with it. We haven't looked at a single policy issue yet. So the aim would be then to move immediately in the following week into the NCBTA cycle. That takes 14 to 18 days. Depending on the NCOP part of this, it could take longer. So the earliest you'll be looking at the carbon tax code is quite frankly middle of November. We would want to finish the carbon tax program. Yeah, we're realizing nothing. We will try work flat out, Mr. Mania has agreed that we could use Thursday afternoon. We will try to finish the carbon tax program. The first meeting will have to be at Saint Martin and be agreed to Washington. Then we will move flat out of the carbon tax bill, the PIC bill, and the bank amendment bill in those 2 weeks later. Now, nobody is going to agree that we sit during December. None of the members we are going to see. So the last date of the sitting is the 29th of November. So Momo, you can go and lobby the President, SG, the Speaker of Parliament, Deputy Speaker, the Secretary of Parliament, the Acting Secretary, the AU, the UN. Good luck. I am telling you now, nobody's telling. Not that we don't have enormous respect for you, we think you're great, and you work very hard, but you know what? We all respect you very much. The truth of the matter is, there's only 25 hours in a day, only a week, and only 8 days in a week, Momo. One day before you drop dead, please recognize, only 8 days in a week, 25 hours in a day. You can't have more. After that, you can close the meeting now.
Well, I don't know whether check in the calendar that says it's 25 hours in a day. Mine goes 24 hours, he's got 28 hours in a day. That's why he can begin to clean in school when they don't have books on the wall. So thank you.
I don't have to really dumb you. She never lost in that day. She went
down the street.
Now I do something stupid.
Thank you very much, all of the members and ladies and gentlemen, for coming out. In the next chair.
I don't know.
Thank you.